We've got time for some questions.
My name is Liam Kane from the School of Education in Glasgow University. It's just a question for clarity, Darlene, about the training providers. Were you looking at the training that happened? Did you look and see what training was going on and then research that? You weren't involved in setting up different kinds of training for politicians?
No, we didn't set them up.
Right, so you just looked at what was there?
Yeah, we were interested in what was already happening.
Right.
Yes.
And were there different agents doing the training? Because it seems kind of more top-down type training in Canada and more kind of network training providers, I'm thinking of.
That's right.
In India. Would that be correct as well?
Right. Yes, we were looking at it just happened that we ended up with the more top-down government training and looking at that as well in Canada. But there's the two trainings that are fairly similar are the Women's Campaign School and the PREA. So those were the ones that we were looking at most. Was one, they're both focused on women, but they just did things very, very differently.
Thanks very much. Three questions. The first one is a question of epistemology, really. And to what extent does the training actually embody women's knowledge and experience, or is it sort of, in a sense, knowledge and experience that comes from other places?
In neither country was it really about women's experiences in that sense. As I said, the strongest emphasis was on practical training. You don't know how to be a politician, and you need to know everything there is to know about being a politician. So the epistemologically, starting from where the women were at, was a fear of not knowing and therefore a need for information. But there was a lot, but in India they did start with the problems of particularly violence in communities. So there was some emphasis of that, but the training programs did start out with you don't know and you're going and you need to know. And the women felt that way as well.
Two other questions. You made a lot of points in the sense that Canada is learning from India, and that's very good, but is there a kind of reverse learning too? To what extent can India learn from the Canadian experience, if at all? And the third question is the kind of categories, the kind of essentialism around gender. And I'm just wondering to what extent, and this may sound naive, but does ideology make no difference, the kind of political parties, the ways in which women's experience is also shaped by the kind of ideological allegiance to male members of a kind of radical party with interest in equality and that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, first of all, Canada 0, India 1. I'm not sure the one thing that India did learn from Canada was the use of politicians. They were in their training programs. Their trainers were adult educators in India, predominantly, and in Canada, the trainers were always women politicians, because there was a belief that no one could understand politics if they weren't in politics, and no one could teach politics if they weren't in politics. So what India did from that, and India had never thought of it in that sense, the trainers in India, so they were just simply using adult educators who had degrees in political science but were not politicians themselves. So one of the things that India found very important and appropriate to use from Canada was to use women politicians coming in and speaking with the women about their experiences, women who'd been in there for a long time, and women who are also in the different, at different levels, at the state level and at the federal level, because there was an attempt to try and encourage. The women are now running for the non-reserved seats, and they're winning. And India is about to go to 50%, or going to try to go for 50% representation. So this was a way to try and encourage women to see beyond the local as well. There's also a fight, an ideological fight around you should not use the local as a stepping stone for others, so you have to get involved in that. So that's my stepping stone into ideology. There is, in the literature, in feminist theory, political theory, there is a lot of talk around, do numbers matter, or is it the ideological orientation that really counts? If we have 400 conservative women and only 3 Labour women, does it matter? Is the world going to change if we have that many women? I don't think our study can answer that question. One thing that I can say is that I personally would argue that you've got to have both. If you do not even have any numbers for women to start collaborating, and when you listen to women talk, now we're at the local level in Canada, so there's less political parties down there, but when you listen to the women talk, there is much more collaboration amongst the women, even though ideologically they are different. Where it becomes problematic to separate all of that is in Canada, the framework for the training was nonpartisanship. Because the only idea there was to just get as many women into power as you possibly could. And therefore, feminism and the kind of discourses that you might have if you used a more feminist framework would have scared those women away, and you don't want to go there with those issues. So there was a lot of that. But I don't think our study answers that, but I would agree that I think you're going to have both. And the women in India are very clear that if without the power of numbers to be able to at least start talking as women and sharing as women, you're isolated, and yet there does need to be a feminist, maybe not a feminist ideology if you don't agree with that, but at least some kind of an ideology that says the world is not okay, as Bud Hall says, that there's got to be some changes here, and we need to start looking at things differently. It's not all economics matter, but it's not all about economics. And so, if we're going to have some changes in society, then we're going to have to. If you want changes in society, you at least have to know that maybe girls should be educated. Maybe you should just give it a thought that it might help, and then worry. Yeah, then later, well, what would that education look like? But I would argue that without the numbers as well, Canada doesn't even have the numbers to even begin with. These women are isolated; they're absolutely isolated on their own. So, without a critical mass, but ideology would matter as well.
My name is Mulgeta, and I'm studying here in Glasgow Uni, Community Development. And my question is basically, it seems to be difficult, like in some societies where some cultural or religious values are deeply rooted in their life, and to change or to initiate some literacy programs to make them participate there and to make changes difficult. So how do we basically encourage such kind of people?
Yes, and in fact, so what India has done is the Dalit, the untouchable class, is also part of the quotas of the reservation system. And one of the things, while there's still problems, one of the Dalit women, because we were focusing our study on women, so one of the Dalit women to be the sarpanch, maybe to, I'll call her the mayor, it's a little different, but maybe the mayor, it's like being the mayor. But she was not, because of her caste, was not allowed to sit down in the chair until she's invited to. So she ends up standing beside the chair all meeting, although she's meant to run the meeting. So that's a way of putting her in her place. And in one instance, none of the women stuck up for her, so therefore she did stand. But I was also watching the big difference of the interaction between the women from very different castes in the room of the workshop, because it didn't matter if you were Dalit, didn't matter what caste or class you were from, you were all part of the training program, and they all just interacted together in a way that was quite phenomenal, and in a way that many of them talked about never having interacted before. So it was one space, the educational space, in which they were able to brought together. That's why, though, what India has done is legislated a change. That doesn't mean that you can't legislate change, but you can legislate change, if you understand what I mean. So they've legislated so that these women are now in power. They can't legislate out the caste system. They've tried. Of course they have. India's legislated out every pain and horrible immorality it possibly can, but it's a very progressive country. You can create through these legal structures a space where different kinds of people are forced to come together. So it was quite magical to watch the room change, although it's not perfect. By no means am I giving you the impression that India is perfect, but India 1, Canada 0.
I'm Roy Trivedi from DFID. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the regional differences in India. You looked at four states. Were there any differences between the states and also within Canada around politics and political parties and the way in which they are approaching women's education?
We didn't look at the way in which the politicians are. There were some small training programs going on, very, very vague, predominantly through websites that we could find from the governments. There was not very much active, or it would be bring them in for an afternoon and talk to them. And the women that we talked to enough women leading up to this for them to say that this is what I learned in there. I learned that you're supposed to be able to read. So there wasn't a lot going on. The four states that I'm talking about, as you know, are the four of the poorest states in India. And that's where Priya has been concentrating their work. But one of the interesting things that you're talking about is that we were at a conference in Toronto, and they put us, a group of us together. They come from around the world, and there was a woman who had done a study of women politicians in Kerala. And at first she was saying, she said, you're in those states, those will be very different. So we made our presentation, we're talking about this, and she got up and she said, I can't believe how many similarities there are. So in spite of the fact that Kerala is a very different, more progressive state, in some ways it's meant to be, the issues and the around inequity remain the same for women. So that, it was quite astounding. In Canada, there was urban-rural, I would say, would probably have been the biggest difference, but much less so, because if you get out into the rural areas, this is where the women only have perhaps a high school education, and they've gone into local politics. And in Canada, there is an allegiance to political parties, but there's no political parties at the municipal level, right? And there are very, even in the Panchayat Raj, there's not the same. We're not talking about you're a party member first, you're a politician first, and you would have a particular interest in parties or an ideology, but you're not part of a political party, and that makes the difference as well. So the next step would be to start looking at the women in the political parties, because then you get attention around the political, the party speak and the non-party speak. But we were interested in these women who were just simply trying to figure it out at the lowest level and get on with it. And get on they are. They are running for the non-reserved seats, and they are winning. They are winning. There's no party. There's no, in the municipal politics, there's no party platforms. It doesn't mean people don't like, have belong, you know, their own little card, but there's no parties. No. So that changes everything. But you know whether it's a left-wing government or a right-wing government that's in. I mean, it's not a, you know, it's not, yeah, but they wouldn't call themselves Tories. They're not Tories. It's actually, we don't have the Tories. We have a Reform Party. You at least have the Tories here. And look out, because the Tories can be really mean, but you don't have the Reform Party, and that's the blistering one.
We've got one big overarching question to come, I think. It's Chris.
Duke, and this is not a big overarching question. It was a reflection on some of the things that you said, which I found really interesting, and a whole lot of them. I've mentioned a couple just in passing. One is in the Indian Sunday papers, you see lots of adverts, still dozens and dozens of adverts for marriage partnerships, which are absolutely explicitly in caste terms still. So you can outlaw it, but there is absolutely in black and white, time and time again. And then I was thinking about a country which I love and spend a lot of time in, Thailand, and that which you think is a very sex-preoccupied country in many ways, and yet gender roles, sex-based gender roles, are actually much more unimportant and much more flexible. And so you get you know, lady boys, and you get people who change gender and so forth. It's really interesting how, I mean, whether that's connected with Buddhism and the history, I don't know. But I was trying to think about some of the deeper culture underpinnings of our...
So you're talking about being less sexually repressed and
it doesn't matter very much.
Yeah, transgressing gender and moving between different kinds of genders and things like that.
Yeah, there's not a them and them.
There is.
Whole spectrum.
Yeah. Well, there isn't.
Move through that spectrum.
Yeah. No, anyway, you'd come in there. No. Yeah. I can't even imagine. Yeah. In Canada, you'd... Oh, yeah. God.
I want to mention something.
You can't even have your skirt much higher than this.
Talk especially interesting, and that is that the EU is running a conference in Bangkok looking at a kind of democracy and governance and all that stuff, and what the EU is bringing to the Asian region. And I read it with interest, so I might, you know, I happen to be there, I might give a paper. It's in Bangkok as it happens.
Right.
But what really struck me was the couching of that. Description in terms of assumption of European democracy being taken to Asia to teach the Asians how to, you know, and there's particular nuances about federal levels and, you know, federal Europe. And then you think about the many ways in which the analogy is daft. I mean, you can lose Europe in one or two of the Asian countries for a start. You look at, I mean, things of scale, but also of the practice, like I came across the thing you touched on, that I think there are 3 million elected women in Indian politics. Well, how many elected women are there in Europe? And so on and so on. So that was a really interesting contexting. And then the thing that I'll put this on to you, because you touched on the end about the far right and the, you know, radical Christians in North America, I should say. I've been reading bits and pieces in recent days that you reminded me of, and I've not had the courage to articulate it, but what I seem to see happening now is that we move from, as it were, my upbringing, which was the rational, optimistic, improving, enlightenment kind of world, where we believed in rationality. We went into that period of which we call postmodernism, which, you know, where everything is relative and everything's as good as or as flawed as everything else. It seemed to be a kind of loss of moral focus and purpose and confidence. What we're now seeming to see, and I see it in a number of comments in places like The Guardian, is that, like, Obama has failed because he is behaving like a rational man, or a rational person, I should say. And actually, the flame is with the emotional people, the people who play on emotions and are successful and talk to the people. And there we have the Tea Party and those very effective Sarah Palin outwards of women leaders. And that's pretty scary. And I shouldn't be saying this, because it seems to be contradicting what you're saying, but it's there as well. And how do we combine... I mean, that's to me, a highly negative kind of emotionality, and I don't like it. But it's still tapping into emotion and heart and instinct, if you like, of a certain kind, against the rationality. And you've got to have the two.
Well, you know, those are very, very difficult kinds of questions to answer. But I'm not as convinced that... I'm talking about political leadership, and therefore there is a belief... That rationality is the important and proper way to go. So I can understand that from the outside and from these women. So it's very, very difficult to get a handle on that. And I'm not sure that I would call the Tea Party what I would consider as passionate at all. I would call them intolerant. So by passionate, the women are, they really, really care about a social justice issue. I'm not sure that the Tea Party, from what I understand from the Tea Party, there's no social justice involved in that at all. In fact, that would be a dirty word in the Tea Party, that kind of thing. That's what the Canadians do. That's what the communists in the north of the border do. The communists in Canada, that's a communist country. It cares about things that don't matter. And so I think you and I are using the idea of passion and caring around justice quite differently from just being loud and outspoken. When the women are talking about that, they don't want to talk about the death of someone in their community and cry in front of the media, because that would be a sign of weakness. To me, that would be something quite wonderful, is for them to let an emotion fly at that moment. So that's more what they're talking about, whereas they have to learn to just, yes, 150 people killed in a flood, pity that. And I'm not saying that that's meant how men do it, but there's a construction of that rational, take it all in, stiff upper lip, if you like, being as, we're not quite there, we're a little bit north of the border of the stiff upper lip, but it may have drifted over.
We'll wrap things up at that point, and let's thank Darlene again for that very stimulating discussion.